would like to welcome all of you to our second expedition into the events of September 11th in a transparent and open and public forum for the American people to see, unlike much of what took place with the proceedings of the 911 Commission. I would also like to thank the expert panelists who are going to be with us today, as well as thank all of you in the audience who are with us. And I definitely want to thank all of the cameras that are here recording these proceedings, because it is through the dissemination of vital information on this subject that the American people will be made aware of what actually happened on that day, when we had four significant failures on one day of $1 trillion military and intelligence infrastructure. I don't think that that is certainly a possible thing to have happened. It's quite a coincidence if it is. And let me also just welcome our expert questioners who will use this opportunity to elucidate all of us, and then all of you will then become expert questioners after we have heard from the panelists.
Good afternoon. I'm David Griffin. There have been two main theories about 9/11, each of which is a conspiracy theory. The official conspiracy theory says that the attacks were planned and carried out entirely by Al-Qaeda. The alternative theory says that the attacks could not have succeeded without the involvement of forces within our own government. In examining the 9/11 Commission report, I have focused on it how it dealt with evidence supportive of the alternative theory. I have found that it did so by distorting or simply ignoring this evidence. This is no surprise, because the man running the commission, Philip Zelikow, was essentially a member of the Bush-Cheney administration. But it is a fact that needs to be brought to light. Because there are so many omissions and distortions, in my book I identified at least 115, I can point to a significant percentage of them only by moving through my list rather quickly. I will begin with the question of how hijacked airliners could have struck the Twin Towers. The Commission's answer was the third answer we have been given to that question. The first answer given by military leaders the first few days after 9/11 was that no fighter jets were sent up until after the Pentagon was struck. The second answer was contained in a timeline put out by NORAD on September 18th, 1 week after 9/11, in which it stated the times at which it had been notified by the FAA about each flight, and then the times at which it had fighters sent up. The Commission failed to mention this change of story. With regard to Flight 11, the Commission claimed that the military received notification about its hijacking 9 minutes before it struck the North Tower. The military was unable to intercept it, however, because Colonel Marr, the head of NEADS, NORAD's Northeast Sector, had to telephone a superior in Florida to get permission, and this call took 8 minutes. The Commission, besides failing to ask how such a call could take so long, also failed to point out that according to Department of Defense procedures, the call was unnecessary. With regard to Flight 175, the Commission claimed that the military received no notification about it until after it had struck the South Tower. But NORAD, in its September 18 timeline, had said that notification had been received at 8:43. A full 20 minutes before the South Tower was struck. So if the Commission's news story is true, then NORAD officials were either lying or their memories were so bad that they got confused 1 week after the events. The Commission, however, failed to press this question. Whenever there is a crisis, the FAA sets up a teleconference with the military. Information about Flight 175's hijacking, it would seem, should have come to the military by means of this teleconference. The Commission, however, claimed that the FAA did not set up this teleconference until 9:20, 17 minutes after Flight 175 had crashed into the South Tower. In making this claim, however, the Commission failed to mention a memo from the FAA's Laura Brown, which said that the teleconference was established within a few minutes after the first tower was struck, which would have been about 8:50. The memo also said that the FAA conveyed information about all flights of interest, which would have included Flight 175. Commissioner Richard Benvenista read this memo into the Commission's record during a hearing in 2003. But the Commission's final report pretends that this memo did not exist. The Commission's claim about the military's ignorance of Flight 175 also ignores a story involving Captain Michael Jelinek, a Canadian who on 9/11 was overseeing NORAD headquarters. According to this story, Jelinek was on the phone with Needs as he watched 175 crash into the South Tower and asked, "Was that the hijacked aircraft you were dealing with?" To which Needs said, "Yes." Some more omissions and distortions involve the question of why the Twin Towers collapsed after being struck by the airliners. The Commission failed to mention that prior to 9/11, fire had never caused steel frame high-rise buildings to collapse, even when the fires were much bigger, hotter, and longer lasting than the fires in either tower. It did not mention, in other words, that all previous collapses had been caused by carefully placed explosives in a process called controlled demolition. The Commission also did not mention that the collapse of each tower had at least 10 features characteristic of controlled demolitions. For example, each collapse began suddenly, came straight down, occurred at virtually freefall speed, and produced an enormous amount of dust, which happens when explosives pulverize concrete into tiny particles. Each collapse was also total, with each 110-story building collapsing into a pile of rubble only a few stories high. How such a total collapse could occur if explosives were not used is a complete mystery, because the core of each tower consisted of 47 massive steel columns. The main explanation for the collapse is a pancake theory, according to which the floors above the hole created by the impact broke loose from the columns and fell on the floor below, thereby starting a chain reaction. But if this is what happened, the core columns would have still been sticking 1,000 feet into the air. The Commission handled this problem by simply denying the existence of these core columns, saying the interior core of the buildings was a hollow steel shaft. Another standard feature of controlled demolitions is, of course, the occurrence of explosions. The oral histories recorded by the New York Fire Department, which were finally released this past August, contain dozens of testimonies about multiple explosions in both towers, which reinforced previously available testimonies. Although the Commission had access to these oral histories, it did not quote any of them. This is too bad, because the authors of the Commission report obviously liked colorful quotations, and the oral histories contain some pretty good ones. For example, firefighter Thomas Turilli, referring to the South Tower, said, "It almost sounded like bombs going off, like boom, 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 like seven or eight." Paramedic Daniel Rivera, describing what he called a frigging noise, said, "Do you ever see professional demolition where they set the charges on certain floors and then you hear pop, 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 pop? That's exactly what I thought it was." Firefighter Edward Cachia, referring to the collapse of the South Tower, said, "It actually gave at a lower floor, not the floor where the plane was hit. We originally had thought that there was like an internal detonation, explosives, because it went in succession, boom, 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 and then the tower came down." Assistant Fire Commissioner Stephen Gregory said, "I thought before number two came down, I saw low-level flashes. I saw a flash, flash, flash at the lower level of the building. You know, like when they blow up a building." Firefighter Richard Benesinski said, "There was just an explosion. It seemed like on television when they blow up these buildings. It seemed like it was going all the way around like a belt, all these explosions." The question of whether explosives had been used could have been settled by a scientific examination of the steel. However, even though removing evidence from a crime scene is usually a federal offense, the authorities allowed the steel to be quickly removed and sold as scrap metal. This removal was protested by the New York Times and Fire Engineering Magazine. The 9/11 Commission, however, did not mention it. The Commission also failed to mention Mayor Giuliani's statement made to Peter Jennings that he had learned in advance that one of the towers was going to collapse. The Commission did not, therefore, need to ask Giuliani why anyone prior to the collapse of the South Tower would have expected it to collapse, given the fact there was no objective evidence or historical precedent for such a collapse. The Commission also did not mention that the CEO of the company that was in charge of security for the World Trade Center was Wirt Walker III, the president's cousin, or that Marvin Bush, the president's brother, had been one of the company's directors. The Commission also omitted many vital facts about the collapse of Building 7. This collapse is especially important because the collapses of the Twin Towers are usually attributed partly to the impact of the airplanes, but Building 7 was not struck by a plane, and yet it collapsed in essentially the same way, showing all the signs of a controlled demolition. The Commission did not mention these facts. It also did not mention that firefighters were removed from Building 7 several hours in advance because someone spread word that it was going to collapse, even though there were, according to all available photographs, fires on only a few of this building's 47 floors. The Commission, again, could have included some interesting quotations from the 9/11 oral histories. For example, DaCosta Wright, a medical technician, said, "I think the fourth floor was on fire. We were like, are you guys going to put out that fire?" Chief Thomas McCarthy said, "They were waiting for 7 World Trade to come down. They had fire on 3 separate floors, just burning merrily. It was pretty amazing, you know. It's the afternoon in Lower Manhattan. A major high-rise building is burning, and they say, we know." But the Commission says nothing about this decision not to fight the fires based on advance knowledge that the building was going to collapse. The Commission also did not mention that Larry Silverstein, the building's owner, said on a PBS show that he and the fire department commander decided it would be best to pull the building, after which we watched the building collapse.
I remember getting a call from the fire department commander telling me that they were not sure they were going to be able to contain the fire. I said, you know, we've had such terrible loss of life. Maybe the smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
The Commission avoided pointing out any of these things by simply not finding any room in its 571-page book to mention the fact that Building 7 collapsed, even though it was supposedly the first large steel frame building in history to collapse solely because of fire. There are also many omissions and distortions related to Flight 77. According to the Commission's new timeline, the FAA did not notify the military about Flight 77 before it struck the Pentagon. Nor has previous timeline, to be sure, had said that the FAA had provided this notification at 9:24. Critics had then pointed out that this notification, coming 14 minutes before the Pentagon was struck, meant that the military should have been able to prevent the strike. The Commission's new story avoids this problem by simply declaring NORAD's earlier statement incorrect, again ignoring the question of whether NORAD officials had been lying or were simply afflicted by terrible memories. Another problem for the Commission's claim is that there were 3 teleconferences going on by then. Why did the military not learn about Flight 77 from, say, the FAA's teleconference, which even the commission agreed began by 9:20? Because, we are told, the person at the National Military Command Center in the Pentagon who was assigned to this teleconference found it worthless and hence didn't pay attention. This account, however, ignores Laura Brown's memo, which reported that the FAA had connected with both the Pentagon and NORAD, with which the FAA shared real-time information about all the flights of interest, including Flight 77. Her memo said, in other words, that the FAA had told the military about Flight 77 long before 9:24. Commissioner Benvenista commented on the significance of this statement at the hearing in which he read the memo into the record. But the commission wrote its final report as if this memo and that conversation never occurred. The commission also had another problem. Fighters had clearly taken off from Langley Air Force Base at 9:30 that morning. NORAD had said that they were sent up after it had received notification about Flight 77's hijacking at 9:24. The commission handled this problem by simply declaring NORAD's statement incorrect. But then the commission had to explain why the Langley jets took off at 9:30. The commission did this by means of a new concept, Phantom Flight 11. That is, the Langley fighters that were really scrambled in response to a false report from the FAA that Flight 11 was still aloft and headed towards Washington. The proof of this claim, we are assured, is provided by an audio file on which someone from the FAA Center in Boston told someone at NEADS about this flight. No reporter can confirm this story, however, because the commission was unable to identify the source of this mistaken FAA information. But the commission failed to explain why, given the sophisticated voice identification techniques now available, it could not identify the two individuals on this audio file. I turn now to problems in the commission's treatment of the strike on the Pentagon. The commission claimed that no one knew that an aircraft was headed towards Washington until about 9:36, just a couple minutes before it struck the Pentagon. But Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta had reported a conversation showing that Vice President Cheney, along with others in the shelter conference room under the White House, knew at least 10 minutes earlier that an aircraft was approaching. The commission, in claiming otherwise, simply made no mention of Mineta's report, even though it had been given in open testimony to the commission. The commission also failed to deal with many problems in the claim that the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was Flight 77 under the control of Hani Hanjour. For example, the aircraft, in order to hit the West Wing, reportedly executed a downward spiral that would have been difficult for an accomplished pilot. And yet Hanjour was known as a terrible pilot. The commission handled this problem by admitting Hanjour's deficiencies on some pages, while claiming elsewhere that he was given this assignment because he was the operation's most experienced pilot. The commission also failed to point out that if terrorists had wanted to cause maximal death and destruction, the West Wing would have been their last choice. It had been reinforced, so the damage was less severe than a strike on any other place of the Pentagon would have been. It was still being renovated, so relatively few people were killed. And the Secretary of Defense and all the top brass were in the East Wing, as far removed from the West Wing as possible. The Commission also failed to discuss several factors that have led some critics to conclude that the aircraft that hit the Pentagon was not even a Boeing 757. This controversy could be cleared up by simply showing the videos that were confiscated from the security cameras at the nearby Sheraton Hotel and the Citgo gas station, but the commission failed to subpoena them or even to mention their existence. Finally, the commission claimed that Al-Qaeda hijackers did not strike a nuclear plant because they feared that their plane would be shot down by anti-aircraft defense systems. But the commission failed to discuss whether the Pentagon is not protected by some such system, which would normally shoot down any aircraft without a U.S. military transponder. There are also many serious omissions and distortions in the commission's treatment of Flight 93. One thing omitted is considerable evidence that Flight 93 was shot down by our own military. The Commission addressed this question only indirectly by constructing another new timeline, according to which the military did not learn about the hijacking of Flight 93 until it had crashed. This claim, however, required ignoring Laura Brown's memo one more time. The Commission also claimed that the military could not have learned about Flight 93 from the White House video conference organized by Richard Clark because it did not include the right officials from both the FAA and the Defense Department. But Clark's book, Against All Enemies, states that the FAA was represented by its head, Jane Garvey, and the Defense Department was represented by Secretary Rumsfeld and General Richard Myers, who was then acting chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. These were surely the right people. Clark says, moreover, that Garvey's list of potential hijackers, which Garvey read while Myers and Rumsfeld were listening, included United 93 over Pennsylvania. The Commission's new timeline also claimed that the shoot-down order was not issued by Cheney until after 10:10, hence 7 or more minutes after Flight 93 had crashed, and that the order was not received by Richard Clark until 10:25. The Commission omitted the fact, however, that Clark said that he received the order at about 9:50. The Commission also failed to mention that, according to ABC News, Colonel Marr at Needs received the shoot-down order and then instructed fighter pilots to destroy the airliner. Another part of the Commission's new timeline is its claim that the Vice President did not arrive in the Shelter conference room until shortly before 10. In making this claim, however, the Commission had to ignore many previous reports, including Norman Mineta's testimony to the Commission itself that Cheney was already in charge down there when Mineta arrived at 9:20. This is part of the evidence that has led me to the conclusion that the 9/11 Commission report is a 571-page lie. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Professor Griffin. My question is very short. I think your research speaks for itself abundantly. My only question is, in your opinion, what should be done with these people who are obviously engaged in a criminal act? And I have to point out that there's people in the mafia who are serving long federal prison sentences for crimes that had much less evidence and were far more circumstantial than what I think you've discovered in your research. So here we have the same bunch, the Bush gang, that was responsible for Iran-Contra and the subsets of BCCI and the SNL scandals, the same group that stole the 2000 election in Florida, and post 9/11, the same group that took this nation to war based on lies and now have participated in population decimation in New Orleans, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Based on that, what do you think? Should RICO come into play, the Racketeer Influence Corrupt Organizations Act, at the very least, and at the very most, charging these people with what my gut feeling is that they committed treason against the United States of America?
Well, thank you very much for presuming I might have an answer to that question. But there is an answer, where we can start anyway. It's for our Congress and our press to start doing its job. And so we can hope that what's going on in this room today is a start. And obviously, if anything is ultimately to be done, you have to have a prosecutor who has subpoena authority, the authority to offer lowerlings a deal in order to name the ones at the top. You have to put people under lie detector tests. In other words, you have to treat 9/11 like what it was, like a crime.
I guess I'm interested in how you answer people who say that if there was widespread U.S. government support for this, there would have had to be so many people involved, in the hundreds perhaps, that the overweening fear would be that there would be one honest American among them to blow the whistle, or at least to scream that a crime had been committed ex post facto. Could you tell me how you answer such critics?
Well, I think there are many layers of answers. First of all, my focus today, of course, was not on the crime itself. It was on the cover-up, and just saying that the 9/11 Commission report ignored and distorted an enormous amount of evidence. But, of course, the obvious inference is that when you engage in such enormous lies and so many lies, then you must be covering up very high crimes. So it does suggest that they're covering up crimes at the highest level. So your question, Ray, is certainly well taken. I would say one level of explanation is that in operations of this sort, and I'm no expert, but this is what I hear, is that really relatively few people have to have the whole picture, that people in different departments and different underlings know only a certain part. Here's what you're supposed to do, and then you're told, and now you're to keep your mouth shut. And we can't explain, but this is for national security. This is for the national good. And so we ask you to not talk to the press and not talk to Congress. And if you do, then we do expect you to lie. But of course, we will protect you if you do. But then if you don't, if you go beyond the bounds, you know, there's going to be some nut who's going to be very upset with you. And I'm just not sure, Joe, that we can protect your wife and kids. So do you think if you were Joe, you would go forward, particularly when there's nobody at the national level saying, please come forward, tell us what you know. And the press is not asking you, please come forward, tell us what you know. No, anybody who speaks up is ridiculed by the press as engaging in, outlandish conspiracy theories and so on. So there is not a climate to encourage people to come forward. That said, there are some people who have been trying to come forward. There, I understand there are some FBI people who want to tell that they had very precise knowledge about the attacks ahead of time, but they have been muzzled and threatened with jail and who knows what if they speak. And so I don't think it's implausible that thus far the lid has stayed on.
David, I'd like to commend you on two excellent books analyzing 9/11 and some great analysis. And I think it's important for all of us here on the panel and for you, because we might be reaching a new audience on 9/11 that we all introduce ourselves and say what we've written, because there might be people going, who was that guy? Where do we find out more? David, what are the titles of the two books you've written about 9/11?
The first one is called The New Pearl Harbor, Disturbing Questions About the Bush Administration and 9/11. And the second is called The 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortion.
David, of course, I've written a book about 9/11, too, and I've had some interesting experiences with mainstream press reviewing or not reviewing or ignoring my book. I found it interesting that New York Times had a copy of my book FedExed overnight the day it was published. They haven't said a word, neither has the Washington Post. What has been your experience with the major media's reception of your books, given that we all know in this room that they contain damning evidence that somebody should pay attention to? How have your books been treated by the corporate powers that be?
They've been ignored entirely, almost entirely. Now, in England, the first book did get a three-page spread complete with photos of the World Trade Center and all that. And it just happened that I was going to be in England, and that landed me a shot on the Richard and Judy show, which is the British equivalent of Oprah. They have a book thing and all. And obviously, it's the place to go. I mean, Bill Clinton looked and said, well, obviously David was on there, so he went on a few weeks later. I'm starting to get a few publications. One week, just the same week, I hit two publications you might consider somewhat at the opposite end of the spectrum. One of them was called Zion's Herald, and the other one was called Hustler Magazine. It's something I hadn't heard of before, but it was interesting. They were the only ones. I tried some what you might call respectable magazines, and they would not answer my letters. Then a few weeks ago, the LA Times Magazine ran a little interview with me, and it was unbelievably well done. So this was actually the first positive treatment in a mainstream publication. So it may be that things are changing. One other thing that ABC, a couple weeks on 9/11, put out some shows on ABC National Radio. And I had a 2.5 minute spot on that. So that's about it.
Very quick 5-second follow-up, David. Why do you think the mainstream media won't touch the truth about 9/11?
Well, as you know, that's a very big question. It has to do with a combination of cowardice, co-optation, and complicity, and corporations, the four C's.
What was the fourth one? Cowardice, co-optation, what, David?
Complicity and corporations. Yeah. Actually, I just made that up. I just.
Bravo.
Welcome.